We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
No Maria this week. She is busy off doing physical labor as we speak.
Yes, exactly. And, she'll be back here next week with an ankle bracelet, so it'll be fine.
Yeah.
It's a good thing because she missed this week because it was a really slow news week, except for the 7 or 8 massive stories.
Nonstop.
So let's get into it.
All right, starting with developments in Olympia with the budget.
Yeah, they finally hammered out a budget yesterday, $33.6 billion for 2 years. On some fronts, it wasn't as bad as it could have been, given that things were hamstrung by a Republican-controlled Senate this year. And we'll talk about that quite a bit more in a minute. But it was still pretty bad. They do have about an additional $1 billion into public schools, which they were forced to do by the McCurry decision of the Washington State Supreme Court. They kept higher education tuition flat for at least the next year, which is unexpected and good news. And there's roughly $2.5 billion in spending increases over the current budget, which is a drop in the bucket compared to how much has been cut over the last number of years. But they still aren't spending nearly what they need to, and it's most of that increase in revenue simply comes from a recovering economy. It does not come from any tax increases, let alone any kind of meaningful structural reform in our tax structure, which pretty much guarantees that over time the budget is going to decline, certainly is going to decline as a percentage of the economy, and that's sort of the cycle that we're stuck in with the state budget. The Democrats had pushed throughout the session for cuts in a number of different corporate welfare measures, corporate tax loopholes that were costing the state an enormous amount of money. They had 15 in particular that were particularly ludicrous and that they had targeted at the beginning of the session. And unfortunately, even the ones that had survived to this point were mostly lost this week. The Republicans, using their insistence on unrelated reforms, such as dismantling the worker comp program, they were willing to drop that only in exchange for Democrats dropping all of their corporate tax loophole in targeting. So the one major tax break that did get eliminated was for telecom companies for landlines. And that the state pretty much had to do because cell companies are threatening to sue the state because it's unfair. They're taxing, giving a tax break to one part of an industry but not another, and not the dominant one at this point. So in exchange for doing that at the last minute, the Republicans actually tacked onto the budget at the last minute, Thursday night and yesterday morning, a number of additional kind of ridiculous corporate tax breaks. So we had breaks for blood banks, mint farms, shooting range clay pigeons, beekeepers, hog fuel, food flavoring, jet repair, dairy products, and a single company, Russell Investments in downtown Seattle. Russell got exempted from a digital goods tax on online data that other companies pay when they're creating products based on web-based information. This has been a point of contention for much of this session. There's the gift to the wealthy of a tax break that exempts out-of-state residents from paying sales tax on large private jet sales and repairs. That got put back in. So a lot of this stuff was either created or put back in at the very last minute with no public input. Lawmakers also freed up money for the operating budget by transferring about $350 million from the capital budget, which means fewer repairs, less money for supporting public works projects, because, gosh, the Skagit River collapse was a long time ago, so nobody could possibly remember it. And yes, by the way, even though it's I-5 and it's a federal highway, the state is the one that's responsible for repairing infrastructure like that. And as we've talked about on this program, there's a huge backlog at both the city and the state level of those kind of infrastructure repairs. And those repairs are come from a separate pot of money, but lawmakers went ahead and transferred some of that money. So it's something of a shell game in that sense. the targets of the inevitable budget cuts that happened this year, and there were quite a few, and of course the budget is a massive document that was just released yesterday, so people haven't had a chance to go all the way through it yet. But among the larger ones that have already been flagged, lawmakers again suspended the voter-approved cost of living increases for school employees. That's about $320 million worth. So since their wages aren't keeping pace with inflation, and aren't even partially keeping pace with inflation, you're actually cutting the salaries of school employees. And they're also indefinitely delaying implementation of a as yet unfunded law that give Washington State's parents 5 weeks of paid time off to be with a new child. Those are the two big ones so we know about so far. So we're going to support education, which is to say spending more money, the $1 billion that was required by the Supreme Court, by effectively reducing the wages of school employees and making it harder for new parents. It's almost like, you know, the lawmakers were taking revenge on kids and their parents and caregivers for having the temerity to ask for adequate funding for education. And of course, that $1 billion is the price tag that the state Supreme Court required in order to, in their view, bring it up to the bare minimum that would pass muster in terms of the constitutional requirement for funding K through 12 education. So it's not like they're doing a good job all of a sudden. They went from doing a disastrous job to doing a way below average job. Meanwhile, we're still waiting. As of this morning, I still hadn't seen anything yet on the Olympia website or in any news reports about whether the Republican-controlled Senate is going to pass a transportation bill. The House has already done so. When the House passed the transportation bill, there was a provision in there that gave King County authority for Metro to be able to go to voters for an extension of the temporary 2-year tax that would run out this summer otherwise and result in 17% funding cuts for Metro. Yes, we're relying on non-Seattle area Republicans who are ideologically opposed to public transit. They're ideologically opposed to tax increases, and they're ideologically opposed to the existence of liberal Seattle. We're relying on those folks in order to avoid 17% cuts to Metro this summer. So we'll see whether that happens in the next day or so before they disband for the year. We'll see. By the way, Metro on Tuesday this week announced its ridership is up sharply after having slumped a little bit during the recession. Their record ridership countywide. In the city, it's actually been quite robust the last several years, but countywide, their highest ridership was in 2008, and they're approaching those levels again now. May's figure of 408,000 riders was close to their all-time record for the month of May. It's, again, an excellent time for Republicans in the state legislature to make sure that, with demand at an all-time high, that Metro's ability to give service is seriously hamstrung. I guess that's something called the free market at work.
A listener writes in that the dance tax was eliminated.
Yes, that is true, so. And that's a good thing, at least for, you know, No, actually, I think, yes, it was eliminated. And what we're talking about here in the dance tax that he's referring to is a tax on establishments. And Ed Murray was primarily responsible for getting this lifted. It goes back to jazzercise clubs in the 1990s and had been broadly interpreted to apply to any kind of an I think it was a B&O tax on any establishment where dancing might happen. It's written really strangely and in an undefined way, but it had been interpreted to mean, you know, a lot of nightclubs and such, like the kinds that we have on Capitol Hill in Ed's district. And he did manage to get that eliminated. And since most of those establishments are fairly small businesses and often locally owned, that's a good thing.
All right.
Not to mention that, you know, it has a, you know, this whole ethic not only of, you know, moral disapproval of dancing and what was the movie where the small town in Utah that bans dancing and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So it's good.
All right.
And particularly on this weekend when there's going to be a lot of dancing. We'll get to that shortly.
Let's move on. City Council passing the public financing bill?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about this. I believe it was last week or the week before. The council passed a financing bill on Monday. It'll be on the November ballot alongside the initiative for district elections. Despite attempts by Nick Licata and Mike O'Brien, who were the two council members who voted against the provision in the end, the bad aspects of this stayed in place. You know, public financing in the abstract is a really, really good idea. It would help make, it would level the playing field so that ordinary people without deep pockets could run for political office. Unfortunately, this is actually worse than no bill at all. It's called a public financing bill. It is a public financing bill, but the way it is written, it is only a public financing bill for incumbents. It is only a public financing bill for people who already have a lot of money. So it actually achieves exactly the opposite of what a public financing bill should achieve. The way it's written, there's a requirement for 600 donors of $10 or more before a candidate becomes eligible for public funds. And when they get the public funds, it's a 6-to-1 match, so that you can get up to it's a little over $200,000 during the course of the campaign. The problem is that the threshold of 600 at $10 or more is one that has only been met by incumbents for the last at least 20 or 30 years that anybody's looked back. And even then, not all incumbents, but certainly no challenger has come close to meeting that threshold. That's a lot of different donations. When the city had public financing previously from 1979 to 1992, the threshold was 300, which is much more achievable and much more common. It has been doubled this time around, even though the amount of money that is raised in a campaign has increased, and that is in large part because the upper limit to campaign donations has been increased over the years. And the number of corporate donors, of course, and out-of-town donors has also increased somewhat, which again skews toward incumbents quite heavily. But particularly for challenger donations, those numbers and to a lesser extent the amount of money that a viable challenger can raise has been much more flat. So it really disadvantages anybody who is not an incumbent, or in the case of an open seat, a very, very deep-pocketed challenger with major establishment backing, the way, for example, we saw Sally Bagshaw operate 4 years ago when she first ran for office and had the support of pretty much all of the downtown Seattle establishment. I forget whether she met that threshold or not. I believe she actually did not. But a candidate like that conceivably could for an open district. But it's a very anti-democratic bill. The thing about it is that it's trying to – public financing addresses a lot of the same issues that creating districts does, because one of the major arguments for districts, aside from neighborhood representation, is that it allows underfunded candidates to be more competitive, because in a district, you actually have a much better chance with yourself and volunteers of – having a geographic base where a lot more people know you, being able to knock on doors, and basically being able to make up for the fact that right now if you run citywide, there's no way 630,000 people can know you personally. You have to raise enough money to be able to do direct mail, to be able to do TV ads and so forth, to get your message out. And it really disadvantages ordinary citizens who want to run. So again, this is going to go to the ballot. It's going to be used as an argument to not have the districts, even though it does exactly the opposite of what it claims it does and what the district initiative is also trying to achieve.
All right. Apartments.
Yeah. Quickly, the city's Department of Planning and Development yesterday issued its recommendations for requirements for apartments. That's the micro housing that's starting to spring up around the city of about 150 to 200 square feet. I think 284 is the upper limit on it. It's basically a room or a room and a bathroom. But a number of those were pretty odd. Notably, they doubled the vehicle parking requirement for units that'll sell primarily into dense urban neighborhoods to people who are poorer than average and or don't need much space, often because they're simplifying their lifestyles or they're environmentally conscious or both. Meaning the people who don't own cars are going to be disproportionately attracted to that kind of housing. Also, younger people who don't, frankly, have as much stuff very often. And yet the city department you know, under this great environmentally conscious mayor who wants us to get away from operating in vehicles, can't seem to divorce itself from car culture and the assumption that, well, everybody has to drive a car or two or three. The other odd part of it was prohibiting the new construction and major renovation of single-family homes that include a micro-dwelling unit with bathrooms, so that if you have an existing home and want to convert part of it into a small rental unit, you can't. And it's very unclear what the difference is between adding a bathroom to an existing bedroom for that purpose and adding one to a micro-housing unit that's part of a larger single-family home. It's just a very ambiguous gray area, and it's not really clear what the rationale is for that. The parking part in particular is very odd, just, you know, because density is fine and well. Micro-housing promotes density and affordability. But if it's tied to the same meme of car dependence and failure to adequately fund public transit, it's missing a large part of the point. And that's what the city appears to be doing.
All right. On to national in a busy week at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, the good news, and for Pride people, it's going to be a massive party all week end along, with the Supreme Court by a 5-4 margin striking down the Defense of Marriage Act, as well as on more procedural grounds, disqualifying Prop 8 in California. And my understanding is they are, starting to issue marriage licenses and marry people in California this weekend. As a result, they lifted the stay on that. So that is a tremendous victory, and the kind of victory that really was unthinkable even 10 years ago, let alone 30. Very often with these social issues, they evolve gradually over time in positive ways. And for those of us who, you know, were born anytime after about 1960, our adult lives have pretty much been a succession of negative developments on social and peace and justice issues, but except for things like that, more rights for women, more rights for non-whites, more rights for sexual minorities and so forth, that usually happen very gradually over time. But in this case, it is not. It's gone very quickly. A lot of people will put a lot of hard work into it, and congratulations, and let's party this weekend for sure. On the other hand, that should not overshadow that the Supreme Court also issued one of its worst decisions in a very long time this week with the Voting Rights Act. And, I know it's a busy week and we got a lot to cover, but I want to go into a little detail because a lot of the national coverage really didn't spell out just how bad the Supreme Court's decision was and how immediate and terrible, the impact is going to be. And we'll start with the majority opinion written by Chief Justice Roberts, who used as his premise that the Jim, and this is a direct quote, the Jim Crow South that Congress put under the federal microscope 5 decades ago isn't the same place today. The South isn't the same place today. In 63, the old white guys who controlled local governments in the South kept the wrong people from voting because they considered them less than human and because they wanted to maintain control. Fast forward 50 years and they do it in order to maintain control and they consider them less than human. It's just totally different. But it's particularly dishonest because his implication is that the Voting Rights Act today is exactly the same as in 63 and it covers exactly the same places. And that is flatly wrong. The Voting Rights Act had, and when it was renewed in 2006, still has options for jurisdictions to both opt out if they demonstrate for over a 10-year period that there's no discrimination against the targeted populations, or to opt in if patterns of discrimination come up. And the fact that many of the same jurisdictions in the South are still covered today that were covered 50 years ago isn't punishing them for their history. It's punishing them for what they continue to do to this day and over the last 10 years specifically. So the entire opinion was built on a very disingenuous and dishonest argument. So there's that. And then Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in her dissent, demonstrates just how dishonest it was because she cited a congressional study from the last renewal of the Voting Rights Act in 2006, and it was approved by the Senate in that year, by the way, 98-0, which means every Republican voted for it, which shows you just how much the Republican Party has been taken over by racists in the last 7 years. So here's Ginsburg. All told, between 1982 and 2006, the Department of Justice objections under the Voting Rights Act blocked over 700 voting changes based on a determination that changes were discriminatory. Above and beyond that, over the same time period, the DOJ and private plaintiffs succeeded in more than 100 actions to enforce the preclearance requirement. And in addition to blocking proposed voting changes through preclearance, the DOJ, in requesting more information from a jurisdiction proposing a change, inspired the jurisdiction to modify or withdraw that change, and the number of those was over 800. So you had about 1,600 discriminatory voting laws in the 24 years between 82 and 2006. That's 67 laws proposed per year, every year, for nearly of a quarter of a century. So there is a problem. And oddly enough, since there is still a problem, you had a number of states where they had the legislation already written and went immediately to implement it as soon as the Voting Rights Act was struck down. Officials in Texas and Mississippi pledged to immediately implement voter ID laws that had been banned because of the discriminatory impact. North Carolina Republicans promised they'd quickly try to adopt a similar law. Florida now appears free to set its early voting hours. They tried this last year, and Florida was an odd situation because there were 5 Florida counties that were still covered under the Voting Rights Act. The rest of the state wasn't. So last year, the rest of the state had these restrictive new laws, but the 5 counties that the feds were monitoring could not use them. And Georgia's most populous county, Fulton County, which is Atlanta, is going to be forced to use county commission districts that the Republican state legislatures drew over local objections. Texas is ready to implement a redistricting plan that a federal court has already deemed discriminatory, and so on and so on and so on. And mind you, that's only for the Voting Rights Act covering parts of 13 states. Unlike 1963, we now have a national party philosophically committed to disenfranchising minorities in every state in the country, including, I might add, Washington State. And they've already done so in a dozen states that are not in the old Confederacy, as well as those within. So what we need and what we really should be demanding of Congress isn't an abolished Voting Rights Act or even a restored Voting Rights Act, but one that covers all 50 states. And that's what we lost.
All right. Further amazing news from this week, Wendy Davis doing a filibuster in Texas.
Yeah. Speaking of Texas, state legislator Wendy Davis became something of a national hero this week. She led a one-woman 13-hour filibuster to block a draconian new anti-abortion law in Texas that went viral on the internet and was wound up toward the end being viewed by literally millions of people. The laws would have closed most, among other things, would have closed most abortion providers in the state and provided for no exceptions for rape, incest, or the mother's health. So this is a law that would have killed women, and she single-handedly saved their lives, at least temporarily, because Governor Rick Perry, of course, has called for a special session to try and pass the same law because the good old boys in the Republican Party in Texas just can't get enough of killing them some women. The interesting thing about this, of course, aside from Davis's heroics, is that she was able to succeed because it was the end of the legislative session and they couldn't act after midnight on that day. They were trying everything possible in terms of procedural maneuvers to try and challenge Davis's filibuster to the point where she could not lean on her desk, she could not take a sip of water, or she could not go to the bathroom for all of those 13 hours. Or her filibuster would have been ended. So it was just a tremendous feat of physical endurance, if nothing else. Even despite that, they tried to force a vote at the very last second. And as everybody saw, the vote itself was not initiated until after midnight, so it didn't count. And Republicans then turned and changed the actual timestamp. This is something being witnessed by millions of people online. So they committed vote fraud. Right on, you know, national internet TV. You know, when you hear Republicans complaining about vote fraud, remember that they're the ones who engage in it in plain sight. And hopefully that law will not be struck down, but I think it really brought home to millions of people in a visceral way just how draconian these pushes are, just how many women's lives and men's lives that it will affect, and the sort of extreme measures that need to be done to combat it.
All right. Senate passing an immigration bill this week?
Yeah, and that's generally good news. And they passed it 68-32, so a number of Republicans signed on, as well as every single Democrat, which was kind of surprising. But it still has to pass the House in order to go anywhere. And the way Speaker Boehner has described things, he's not going to pass a bill that a majority of his caucus doesn't support, and a majority of his caucus is not at all interested in any of the provisions the Senate have, because they don't do nearly enough to keep brown people away and punish the ones that are already here. So who knows what, if anything, we're going to get out of this. I think chances are very good that we won't even get immigration reform to a vote in the House. And if they do get it to a vote in the House, it'll be a dramatically different bill from the one in Senate, and we won't get a vote on a conference compromise to that. And in fact, there's also a question of whether the House would even assign people to a conference committee. So the likely outcome of this, I think, is that the House, as has been its want under Republican control, will pass something that it knows has no chance of ever becoming enacted in law, and then will refuse to negotiate on it, and it'll die. But the fact that the Senate voted for it is tremendous progress, but we've still got a long way to go to get it into law.
All right. And President Obama doing a speech about climate change.
Yeah, major speech. Obama has, I think, finally realized about 5 years too late that he's never going to get anything through Congress around climate change, because a certain party listens to their imaginary sky friends, and more relevantly, their people in the fossil fuel industry. And so he realized that he could actually do quite a bit through the executive branch without relying on the legislature. And that's much of what the speech on Tuesday was about. There were three major planks: carbon cuts at coal-fueled power plants, which there's enormous resistance to in the Congress, both from Republicans and from Democrats from coal-dependent states like, you know, West Virginia and et cetera. So that part is very good. He's also talking about spending to fortify cities and states against the ravages of storms and droughts and, you know, in a longer term, sea level rises. That's something that's necessary. There'll be new federal funds to advance renewable energy technology. That's a good thing. All of it in the media was overshadowed. And then, of course, it was also overshadowed almost immediately by all the Supreme Court decisions and the other major stories this week. By his announcement that he, quote, would not approve the 1,700-mile pipeline, meaning the Keystone XL pipeline, if it was shown that it would significantly worsen climate change. Now, that is a statement that both opponents and supporters of Keystone XL took to heart as meaning that their side was going to win. The problem with that is the definition of significantly, and to what degree they're talking about the entire project, from the tar sands itself to the transportation of it to the use of it, or just strictly the pipeline and the transport of the oil. Because if it's just the transport of very dirty oil, you know, that itself doesn't really significantly impact climate change. It's what happens when it's used. It's what happens when it's extracted. So we'll see. The State Department is due to issue a ruling really at any time now, and it's broadly expected that they will approve it. And then certainly within the environmental community and really society-wide, all hell ought to break loose, because it's a terrible, terrible project.
All right. Events.
Today, this evening, actually, our friends at the Backbone Campaign are having a really cool fundraiser, Chocolatada. So if you like chocolate, and I hear a rumor that many people do, it'll be a chocolate-infested benefit for Backbone Campaign, which does awesome work. That will be at Om Culture. It's a yoga studio and, I guess, a space where you can have fundraisers. off of Gasworks Park at 2210 North Pacific Street, just northeast of Gasworks on the lovely northern shore of Lake Union. Also this week, of course, there are all kinds of Pride events going on. The highlights are the Capitol Hill Pride Festival that will start in a couple hours from now and run from 11 to 6 today. The Pride Parade, which is a huge thing, it'll kick off at 11 o'clock from 4th and Union and then go north through downtown to Seattle Center. And that parade literally takes a couple hours to unwind. And then, of course, Pride Fest will be going on at Seattle Center as well.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Joff Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.